From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It was the same sense of civic responsibility that led me into the Marine Corps, that led me out of the Marine Corps, that led me straight to Al Jazeera.
Josh Rushing, a Marine Corps spokesperson turned Al Jazeera correspondent. He's written about his experiences in his new book, Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. Then war and censorship at Wilton High. After their principal banned the play about war, students bring it to the New York stage. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, up to 80 people were killed and more than 85 wounded in a suicide truck bombing on a Baghdad mosque. The attack came as the U.S. military launched one of its largest operations of the Iraq War. At least 10,000 troops have been deployed around Diyala province against what the military says are al-Qaeda groups. Meanwhile, Iraq's largest aid group is warning a record number of civilians, mostly women and children, are fleeing their homes to avoid worsening violence. In a new report, the Iraqi Red Crescent says the number of internal refugees has quadrupled since January. An increasing number of pregnant women are being forced to obtain illegal abortions because of a lack of available medical care. In Washington, D.C., President Bush met with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert Tuesday to voice support for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and back the continued isolation of the Gaza Strip. Abbas dismissed the democratically elected Hamas-led government last week after Hamas forces seized control of Gaza. The U.S. has lifted the aid embargo on the West Bank while promising to tighten the blockade on Gaza. President Bush said he hopes Abbas will lead Palestinians in a different direction.
Our hope is that President Abbas and the Prime Minister Fayyad, who's a good fella, will be strengthened to the point where they can lead the Palestinians in a different direction, with a different hope. The Prime Minister has spoken to me, and I've spoken to him about, you know, our desire to help suffering Palestinians. Nobody likes suffering on their border. Nobody likes to see suffering in the world.
Meanwhile, Gaza's humanitarian crisis is growing. Hundreds of Palestinians are trapped in Gaza's border crossing with Israel, trying to flee to the West Bank. An estimated 10 people have been let in so far. The Israeli group Physicians for Human Rights is asking Israel's high court to order immediate entry for all Palestinians in need of medical treatment. As the situation in Gaza declines, tensions are escalating between the two Palestinian factions. On Tuesday, former Gaza security chief Mohammed Dahlan called Hamas militants in Gaza an occupation force.
The Palestinian National Authority and President Abu Mazen and the PLO is in charge politically and legally of the West Bank and Gaza. There is no place for things that we are hearing, and all these matters that took place are illegal, and we will not recognize it at all. In reality, Hamas is besieging the Gaza Strip. We will treat it as an occupation force, but we will resist the occupation.
That was former Gaza security chief Mohammed Dahlan of Fatah. Senior Hamas leader Khalil al-Haya vowed that Hamas will not relinquish its new control.
Hamas will be completely taking over responsibilities in order to serve. If we have to choose between us and between caretaking for the West Bank, we will take on our full responsibility in Gaza, and we will not allow anyone to take over this responsibility from us or interfere in the government's authority.
In Cuba, memorial services are being planned for Vilma Espin, the late wife of acting Cuban President Raul Castro and widely viewed as the First Lady of Cuba. Espin was a key figure in the Cuban Revolution and founded the Cuban Women's Federation. This is Havana resident Francisca Hernandez.
It is a very painful loss because it deals with one of the heroines of this country, a woman who sacrificed much, who gave everything for the revolution.
A diplomatic row is widening over Britain's decision to knight the writer Salman Rushdie. On Tuesday, Iran told the British embassy the move was a provocative act. In 1989, Iran's Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini sentenced Rushdie to death because of Rushdie's depiction of the Prophet Muhammad in his book, The Satanic Verses. Pakistan's national parliament has passed a resolution demanding Britain retract the award. This is Pakistan's Minister for Religious Affairs, Ishazul Haq.
people like Salman Rushdie who do not carry any weight anywhere in the world. So we start encouraging people like this. I'm sorry, the gulf between the Western countries and the Muslim Ummah is going to widen, and it has hurt the feeling of every Muslim who is alive.
The international aid group Oxfam has announced it's pulling out of the largest refugee camp in Darfur. Oxfam says local authorities in Grida have failed to prevent violence against aid workers. Grida is under control of the Sudan Liberation Movement, which took part in peace agreement last year. In Washington, D.C., Senators Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island are demanding a probe into allegations Republicans deliberately tried to prevent people of color from voting in the 2004 elections. Internal emails show Republicans, including former Karl Rove aide Tom Griffin, sent so-called voter caging lists designed to challenge voters from casting ballots. The caging lists were skewed towards targeting people of color, predominantly African Americans. Griffin announced his resignation as U.S. attorney in Arkansas earlier this month. Meanwhile, a former senior Justice Department official is being accused of blocking several challenges to the violation of voting rights of African Americans. In a letter to the Senate Rules and Administration Committee, seven former employees of the voting rights section say the official, Hans von Spakovsky, blocked at least three lawsuits and two investigations into voting discrimination. Von Spakovsky is seeking a new six-year term on the Federal Election Commission. The former employees say his nomination should be rejected. A federal judge has blocked a Dallas suburb from enforcing a sweeping anti-immigration law that would have barred the rental of homes to most undocumented immigrants. Landlords and Farmers Branch would have been forced to check if renters are U.S. citizens or visa-approved immigrants before giving them a lease. U.S. District Judge Sam Lindsay ruled town officials were trying to regulate immigration separately from the federal government. Here in New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg has announced he's leaving the Republican Party to become an independent. The announcement is fueling speculation. Bloomberg is preparing a run for the White House. Meanwhile, more news has emerged that could hurt the election chances of another former New York mayor, Republican hopeful Rudy Giuliani. Newsday has revealed Giuliani dropped out of the Congress-backed Iraq study group last year after he failed to attend a single meeting. Giuliani was given an ultimatum to either show up at the sessions or step down. Both of his absent meetings conflicted with scheduled speaking appearances where he collected hundreds of thousands of dollars in fees. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 4 years ago, our first guest today helped sell the Iraq War to the American public, armed with talking points from the Bush administration. Josh Rushing served as a Marine spokesperson at CENTCOM in Doha as the U.S. invaded Iraq. Josh Rushing has since retired from the Marines and has started working at an unlikely outlet, the Arabic news channel Al Jazeera International. Rushing became famous in the Arab world after he appeared almost by chance in the documentary Control Room about Al Jazeera. After the film was released, the Marines ordered Rushing to stop speaking to the press because he'd begun publicly defending Al Jazeera. When the network launched an English language channel, Rushing was offered a job. Josh Rushing writes about his transition from the Marines to Al Jazeera in his new book, Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. Josh Rushing joins us now in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Why did you join the Marines?
I joined the Marines out of a sense of civic responsibility. My parents believe in that. You have to give something back. So essentially my sister and I were raised either a teacher, military, fireman, police, something along those lines. You've got to do it at least for a few years. So when I graduated high school, I was looking for ways I could put myself through college. I was looking for ways I could give back to my community, and it led me to the Marine Corps.
So you went into the Marines. Where did you go? Where did you begin? Where was your basic training? And then where did you end up?
Sure. Well, it was 14 years of active duty, but long story short is I went to basic training in California and San Diego. Everyone west of the Mississippi goes to boot camp in San Diego. East goes to Parris Island, South Carolina. From there, I went through infantry school, Camp Pendleton, California. They pulled me out to be a journalist, oddly enough, for the Marine Corps, a print journalist, and sent me to journalism school in Indianapolis at a military base. From there, I traveled the world for the next several years writing for military newspapers and magazines. selected for a college program. I went to University of Texas, still active duty, got a degree in the classics in ancient history while there, became an officer, went through infantry school again as an officer, went to flight school, ended up back in my old field eventually of public affairs, being a media liaison. Eventually ended up working in Hollywood, representing the Marine Corps to the entertainment industry. And then for 6 months, I was pulled
Explain
out.
Explain that part, the representing the Marine Corps to the entertainment industry. Explain how Hollywood works with the military.
Sure. It depends on how you look at it. The military looks at it as an educational opportunity. They realize how influential Hollywood is in shaping people's views of the military and everything else for that matter. So what they do is that they make government bases, planes, tanks, personnel, all available to Hollywood if a script is in some way deemed educational and pretty close to accurate. More important to be educational than actually accurate. And my job was to go through the script, make sure there was some value for the American citizen and the government participating in that, and then making sure the government was reimbursed to the penny so that it didn't cost taxpayers anything.
And if they didn't like a script, they wouldn't allow them to use the...
I spent more time saying no than yes to projects. For example, Jarhead. It was a book. I actually loved the book, Anthony Swofford's account of his time in the Gulf War, the first one. But I had to say no to the script. Even though the military tech advisor was a friend of mine, even though the writer of the script, Bill Boyles, is a former Marine, and then Sam Mendes directed American Beauty, my favorite movie. But we said no because it just had inaccuracies and it didn't show the events as they were, and it lacked what I guess was an educational element.
I remember interviewing the author of Black Hawk Down saying, yeah, I changed the script to make the military happy because they wanted to use, I mean, it's, to say the least, very dramatic when you can have millions of dollars of U.S. military money invested in a film.
There was a scene in Black Hawk Down where it had a senior officer slapping a junior enlisted member across the face. And the scene was pulled from the script. And then the director, who's, I'm forgetting right now,
the wanted author to was Mark Bowden.
Mark Bowden, exactly, yeah. Wanted to insert it back into the script, and the military pulled all the gear from the movie. And the movie used a ton of military stuff. They filmed it in Morocco. It had all these military helicopters, millions of dollars worth of military stuff that they just couldn't have otherwise. In the civilian world, you can't get some of the things the military has. So...
Ridley Scott was the director, right?
Ridley Scott, that's right. That's right. Scott wanted to put it in. It became a big showdown between Scott and an Army major. And the Army major pulled all the aircraft, and they sat on the set for several days, millions of dollars a day, passing by into the studio, said, okay, Scott, drop the scene. And then they moved forward with the project. The job in Hollywood at its worst is when it's used for nothing but spin, when it's used for... shaping movies to sell, you know, a message that may
Well, that's
may
certainly
not be true.
The power. So, I mean, if they can withdraw millions of dollars worth of military gear.
Absolutely is. And it really depends on the personality and the job. The same civilian's been in charge of it at the Pentagon for years now, a guy named Phil Stroop, who's not a bad guy. And he was my boss when I worked in Hollywood. But an example is A Few Good Men. And do you remember the movie with Tom Cruise? And it's about a Marine squad. They kill a Marine down in Gitmo, actually. And then it's a cover-up to the highest levels down there. And Tom Cruise is a Navy lawyer that kind of unravels the whole plot. That script, which I think is actually a great movie, Aaron Sorkin wrote it, was rejected by my office years ago. They denied support for it. I looked at the script and the project and what they were asking for just out of curiosity when I was in the office, and I would have supported it because in the end it showed the colonel played by Jack Nicholson as being arrested and taken away. So it showed there are some bad apples even at those very high levels, but that institutionally the institution wasn't corrupt. So I would have supported that movie in a heartbeat. So it really depends on the personality of the person in that office as to how they use it.
Interestingly, Tom Cruise in that film, A Few Good Men, was playing David Iglesias, who was the U.S. attorney who was fired in this whole U.S. attorney scandal under Alberto Gonzalez.
Really?
As
I didn't
a
know
young
that.
Attorney.
Huh. I didn't know that was based on a real real person at all.
I believe it was.
Oh, that's fascinating. It all comes back full circle.
Let's go forward from Hollywood to the war in Iraq. because you do have CENTCOM, where you served, that ended up being this multi-hundred-thousand-dollar set to present the war on Iraq. Explain.
Yeah, I was pulled out for 6 months to go from my Hollywood job to CENTCOM. There was actually no relationship between the two. And ironically, I'm known for a movie out of CENTCOM rather than out of my Hollywood job. But I went to CENTCOM to be a spokesperson for General Tommy Franks in Central Command, where, there was a lot of production value there for a military, spokesperson's office. We had a $200,000 set meant for generals to give the daily briefing from. It was intended to look very high-tech and send the message to, the world that down to the last detail, we were the most high-tech, tech-savvy army ever, and that kind of thing. But I think a lot of people find it shocking to bring in a Hollywood set designer to set up a stage for a general to give war briefings from. It tells you you're in a new stage of the information age, doesn't it?
Talk about the kind of information that was presented at CENTCOM and how you were feeling as someone in the Marines who was part of shaping that message and how you changed along the way.
This part was really rough for me because as a military spokesperson, you don't talk about policy. You talk about the way you're going to conduct an action, not why you're going to conduct an action. So if someone were to ask me before the war, why are you going to invade Iraq? And reporters did. The only honest answer I could give is, we'll invade Iraq if the president orders us to. And we won't if he doesn't. We don't get to pick and choose our battles. That way, it's left to a politician in a suit behind a podium at the White House to explain why they made that decision. But instead, what we did, we had a Republican operative who was put in charge of our office, displacing a colonel that had started doing media liaison when this Republican operative was about probably 5 years old. And what this guy knew how to do was run a campaign. And so we were run like a political campaign. And the first step in that political campaign was to sell the product, and that was sell the invasion. So they gave the reasons down to the young troops, guys like me, to go out to reporters and give the reasons we're going to invade a sovereign nation. Here's the problem. The reporters in no way had the latitude to ask someone in uniform a critical question. I mean, on MSNBC, their coverage was actually packaged with the banner that said, "Our hearts are with you." So when I'm the young troop in uniform on screen and the viewer sees, "Our hearts are with you," do you think the reporter's going to ask me a critical question? Of course not. But I'm out there giving political answers. I'm out there saying, we're going to invade Iraq. And this was the real catch. They would ask me before I would go on air live, are there any messages you want to get across today? Well, yeah, my boss comes straight from the White House, and they have the messages of the day, and so they would give it to us. So I say, sure, WMD, regime change, ties to terrorism. And they go, okay, well, I'll ask you these questions so we can get those answers out. I pick on Fox a lot. Reporters would do it, but NBC did it as well. Those two were probably the worst about it because those two were the most competitive about wanting access. I think they saw this as kind of part of the game. So we would go on live. They would ask me, the staged questions. They would pat me on the back and thank me for my service. And then back to you, John, in New York. And the answers I gave weren't the way we were going to conduct an action. They were the political reasons for invading another nation. And I was just a junior officer. So it was really kind of startling the way that all went down.
Jim Wilkinson, who is he?
Jim Wilkinson is a Republican operative I was talking about. He's a guy that, he's about my age. He's from a small town in Texas. Again, I don't believe he's a bad guy. I disagree with what he was ordered to do, what he volunteered to do. He worked in Dick Armey's office. He is credited with coming up with a line about Gore and having invented the Internet. That was Jim's work. Then in the 2000 elections, he was in charge of the media down in the Florida recount, where there was one point where the Dade County voting board was going to recount the ballots down there. The Republicans didn't want him to recount it until a decision had been made by the courts. And so they stormed the office. The office had to shut down, couldn't do the recount. It was Jim in the press. You can go back and look at the articles who says it was just a moment where a bunch of Americans felt the voting process was being taken away from them. And so, they got a little over-emotional, and that's what happened. But if you actually look at the pictures, it's called the Brooks Brothers riot these days because everyone in the picture, the rioters are all in bow ties and nice suits and Natalie attire, and they're young, 20-something, blonde hair. And if you start to kind of circle the faces and identify them, they're all congressional staffers, Republican congressional staffers. But if that was an organized event, it would be illegal. It would be voter intimidation. So moving them across state lines to perform that kind of thing, because they were all out of Washington, D.C. So it was that's why Jim was in the press saying, oh, you know, this wasn't organized. These were just emotional people who felt the system was being taken from their grasp.
So it was this party operative, Republican Party operative, that was designing, that was setting the scene at CENTCOM.
Yeah, he did so well there down in Florida. The next place he pops up is September 14, 2001, right here in New York, where he hands the bullhorn to President Bush for Bush to tell the workers at Ground Zero that I hear you and soon the world will hear you. And it's a huge media event. And that again, was Wilkinson. Wilkinson goes from there to CENTCOM.
We're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to play a clip of Control Room that made you famous around the world. We're talking to the Marine spokesperson turned Al Jazeera reporter, Josh Rushing. His new book is called Mission Al Jazeera. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also translated into Spanish in audio and transcript form, and any radio station can run them, as 150 stations are. You can, too. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Josh Rushing. His new book is Mission Al Jazeera, Build a Bridge, Seek the Truth, Change the World. I want to turn to an excerpt of the documentary Control Room about Al Jazeera. This clip goes back to the opening weeks of the war in 2003, when Al Jazeera broadcast footage of captured U.S. soldiers. In this excerpt, you'll see Al Jazeera journalist Hassan Ibrahim, Joanne Tucker, the manager of AlJazeera.net, and finally, Josh Rushing. But it starts with U.S. Army Specialist Shoshana Johnson being shown as a POW on Al Jazeera.
Where are you come from?
Texas.
You come from Texas?
Yes.
How old are you?
30.
Yes?
13.
30 سنة.
إذن مشاهدينا كانت هذه الصور التي حصلنا عليها من التلفزيون العراقي والتي تظهر عددا من القتلى والأسرى الذين سقطوا في معركة
Rumsfeld is saying parading the footage of the captives is a violation of the Geneva Convention. What do you call Guantanamo Bay? What do you call the Iraqi soldiers paraded yesterday on American television? What do you call bombing a city without authorization from the UN Security Council? Now there's a Geneva Convention.
The decision by Al Jazeera to broadcast such material is deplorable, and we call on them to desist from future broadcasts of such a nature.
Are we sure about this news? Are we sure? Okay.
There's a lot of pressure, obviously, on Al Jazeera to withdraw those pictures. Were you surprised by the reaction to those photographs?
I think They were understandable. The reactions didn't really surprise me. If you're an American and you're seeing dead Americans, of course it's going to affect you and you're going to have an emotional reaction. But, you know, let the people understand that this is a war and people are dying. It's not a clean war. It's a very messy war. It will continue to get messier.
Your journalists have a position on the war. Are they capable of being objective?
That's a good question, but I ask the same question. I'll answer the question by asking the question. Are any U.S. journalists objective about this war? Are any of the news broadcasts that I tune into not taking a position on the war? And that's absolutely shown.
Does that justify your position then?
No, but I'm just trying to show that this word objectivity is almost a mirage. You know, if you're in the States, I mean, the amount of rage directed against us because we showed soldiers who had died in combat or in an ambush, they were soldiers who had died in a war zone. There was rage directed against us. If there was no agenda, if there was true neutrality, there would be a welcoming of any and all information from all sides.
The night they showed the POWs and the dead soldiers, Al Jazeera showed them. It was powerful because America doesn't show those kind of images. Most of the news in America won't show really gory images, and this showed American soldiers in uniform strewn about a floor, a coal tile floor, and it was revolting. It was absolutely revolting. It made me sick at my stomach. And then what hit me was the night before there had been some kind of bombing in Basra, and Al Jazeera had shown images of the people, and they were equally, if not more horrifying, the images were. And I remember having seen it in the Al Jazeera office and thought to myself, wow, that's gross. That's bad. And then going away and probably eating dinner or something, and, you know, it didn't affect me as much. So the impact that had on me realizing that I just saw people on the other side, and those people in the Al Jazeera office must have felt the way I was feeling that night, and it upset me on a profound level that I wasn't as bothered as much the night before. It makes me hate war, but it doesn't make me believe that we're in a world that can live without war yet.
Josh Rushing, in the film Control Room, former Marine spokesperson, now actually works at Al Jazeera English, Al Jazeera International. As you watch that, your thoughts?
It's just still hard to watch some of that footage. And I think it's kind of interesting because now I understand the process I was going through, and I didn't understand it at the time. I didn't recognize it at the time, but it's a universal thing that we all do. We all feel most empathetic for those who appear most like us and least empathetic for those who appear, you know, least like us. And I think going into the war, the Arabs and the Iraqis were clearly the them. They were least like me. But the longer I was there and the more time I spent with them, the more I realized we had in common than in difference. And in doing that, without quite realizing it intentionally, I was gaining a real sense of empathy for them, realizing we had so much more together than we did apart. And that's why I realized that their dead should hurt me as much as our dead.
Tommy Franks, you asked the general to start talking to Al Jazeera.
I did, yeah. I asked him. Actually, it was just simply to call on an Al Jazeera reporter first at a press conference. It's kind of a sign of respect. And his response was, yeah, sure, right after I rip off his head and, I can't say the word, I got crap down his throat. And then it kind of moved on. And he's a four-star general, and I was a young lieutenant, and there's not much I can say in response to that. But it clearly showed their attitude about, you know, engaging Al Jazeera. I mean, if you won't even call on them first at a press conference, forget about giving their reporters any kind of access to senior leadership or, to information, to empowering their reporters in a way that they could tell the CENTCOM story. Absolutely forget about that.
I wanted to turn to a clip of British Lieutenant Commander Steve Tatham. He was the head of the British Royal Navy's media operations in the Northern Arabian Gulf. He served as the British Navy's spokesperson in the critical months leading up to, during, and after the Iraq invasion. He was responsible for war correspondents embedded with British troops and for responding to the flood of media inquiries during the invasion. Tatham worked alongside U.S. military planners in the Gulf, coordinating the huge media campaign that foreshadowed and accompanied the Iraq War. He also wrote a book called Losing Arab Hearts and Minds, the Coalition Al Jazeera and Muslim Public Opinion. I went to his house, Lieutenant Commander Steve Tatham's house, last year, and this is some of what he had to say.
There's a press briefing with American forces where all of the media are invited to attend. It's a sit rep on the operational situation. But as Al Jazeera go into that briefing, they're stopped by a US officer and said, no, sorry, not you guys. You're a channel with a reputation. Now, perhaps it's my British sense of fair-mindedness, but it does seem paradoxical that we're inviting the rest of the world's media in and we're not too concerned about them, but the Arab media can't come in because we're concerned about their reputation or about what became the new four-letter word, their bias, one way or the other. And that struck me as entirely counterproductive to trying to win this war of ideas and explain who we were.
Steve Tatham also talked about how at the British briefings they had the translations of the Arabic newscasts so that they could get a sense of how the world was watching. But in the United States, trying to, at CENTCOM, get people to watch the media, the Arab media, understand what was being conveyed, that was almost blasphemous.
It was impossible. Now, I have to say, we had a bank of television screens in our office, and one of them was on Al Jazeera. As a matter of fact, there's a picture in the book of me giving an interview, and it's a picture of that screen in our office, and I'm on Al Jazeera. Problem was, we had no translators to tell us what they were saying. All the translators were, I guess, needed up in Iraq, and that kind of that makes sense. But, you know, if you're looking at this broader issue of how the U.S. is engaging the Arab world, I think someone probably should have been paying much closer attention to what they were saying on Al Jazeera.
So let's talk about this transition from Marine spokesperson to Al Jazeera reporter. How did it happen? How did you end up leaving the military? And what are your thoughts on CENTCOM now that you have a different position?
Sure. excuse me. When I left the war, it was in July of 2003. I've been there for 6 months. I was frustrated because I couldn't gain Al Jazeera better access at CENTCOM. I couldn't gain him any access other than, you know, the young lieutenant. I thought that Frank should have, excuse me, had an Al Jazeera reporter. Pardon me.
Well, I'll just use this opportunity to say we're talking to Josh Rushing. His book is Mission Al Jazeera. Yes, Josh. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I apologize. I thought Frank should have had an Al Jazeera reporter beside him when he went into Baghdad. I thought that they should have given Al Jazeera amazing access to explain to the world why they were doing what they were doing, or we were doing what we were doing. But that wasn't the case, and I came back really frustrated about it.
One thing on that. You were saying that it was U.S. reporters, in fact, Fox reporters, that actually, mm-hmm. when talking about coordinates of U.S. forces, they were the ones who were violating the U.S. military rules.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the Geraldo Rivera case, which is rather famous. You know, he's on live TV, and he has the camera panned down to the sand, or he draws the map on where they are and where the unit's heading in clear violation of the ground rules and putting the very unit there at risk. It was that was Fox.
And you have the reporter talking about where to hit an Abrams tank.
Yeah, sure. It was a live report. The reporter was saying, you know, there's an Abrams tank on fire behind him, which was unusual at the time. I mean, at that point of the war, they thought the Abrams tanks were, you know, invincible. And so he's pointing to the tank behind him that's on fire and says, apparently the RPG got in through here in the side, and there's must be a weakness there in the tank. So anyone watching that would say, well, if I'm going to fire an RPG at the Abrams, I'll wait till I can get into that spot. Thank you very much, Fox News, you know. And yet, Fox got great access, and Al Jazeera was just shunned. And what would be more important than explaining to the Arab people why they're taking these kind of military actions in the Arab world? I couldn't understand it. So I came back and I was frustrated, but I was a young officer who would listen to me. Well, 8 months later, I find out about the movie at Sundance. I didn't know a movie had been made about me. I was introduced to these two filmmakers as students from the University of Cairo as doing a master's project following around some Al Jazeera producers. I had no idea what it was going to become, and they showed it. They screened it at Sundance, and they hadn't contacted me to say, hey,
This is Control Room.
Control Room, yeah. Hey, we actually made a movie and you're one of the characters. I wasn't supposed to be a character. They had a different character and they dropped him out kind of at the last moment and put me in. But they didn't contact me to let me know. So it was literally someone in the audience called me in Los Angeles and left a voicemail and said, hey, I just saw your movie and wanted to say thanks. And I had no idea what he's talking about. And I found out by Google, the way everyone finds out everything now. You know, Josh Rushing, Sundance, and Up Came Control Room. I've never heard of this movie. And, well, all the media in America had requested to speak to me about the movie. And the Pentagon, who hadn't seen the movie, didn't want to deal with it, didn't know why a junior officer was in a movie about Al Jazeera anyway, said no comment, which really just fueled the fire. I mean, it took all the coverage of me from the entertainment section, the calendar section of newspapers and magazines, to the front page of the L.A. Times, to the editorial pages of the L.A. Times and the New York Times, taking an official position on why I should speak about this. And what I realized was I was the only person in the world, who had been inside the Pentagon, the Bush administration, and Al Jazeera studios. And I had a unique vantage point. And what I saw was that Al Jazeera wasn't what America thought it was. I saw what it actually was, and also saw why it was so important to America's own strategic interests, much less to the world getting along a little better. And so I had a civic responsibility to say that to America. I couldn't say it as a Marine. So I resigned my commission with no jobs, no opportunities, no savings. I took a second mortgage on the house to get by. No health care. And I went out to the media, particularly the most conservative media I could. I went on O'Reilly. I went on all the Fox stuff because these are the people who needed to hear it. And I was the only person out there who could go on a show like that and not be dismissed, you know, as a lefty from Berkeley and say, wait a second, I'm from Lone Star, Texas. Dad's a firefighter. Mom's on the city council because they believe in civic service. Been a Marine my entire adult life, and I've given up everything to say, you've got to reconsider Al Jazeera. So I did that for a few months. I was unemployed, and then I got a call saying, hey, we're going to start an English language Al Jazeera. I'm from the BBC, and I'm going to head up their program department. I saw your movie. Why don't you come by, and we'll talk about maybe doing something together. And thank goodness I did. I was about to be a PR guy in Houston. You know, I had to take a job. And so they came along right at the right time, and it's worked out really well.
Talk about that first story you went out on. Talk about going to North Dakota and what happened.
Yeah, you know, it seemed like a simple story. We're going to go do a story about small-town America. And there's actually a part, and you know, the country's obsessed with immigration, how many people are coming over the border. Well, there's one part of North Dakota, it's kind of western, northwestern North Dakota, where the towns are actually emptying out. All the kids are graduating, going away, and not coming back, to the point there's actually small towns that will give you money to put your children in the school system there, and land. They'll give you free land to build your house on, just trying to attract somebody to keep these communities alive. So I wanted to see what's the value in these communities. So it's a real nice, charming story, extolling the values of small-town America. Well, I go up, and it was kind of interesting because a reporter came out on my first day there, a reporter from the local paper, and she said she was surprised at how I was dressed. And I thought, well, maybe I'm kind of casual to be on TV. I was in blue jeans. And she said, no, I thought you'd be in robes and a headscarf. You got to be kidding. Why would I be in robes and a headscarf? Well, you're Al Jazeera, you know, and that's what we were looking for. So it was...
So she came out to do a story on you.
Yes.
Doing a story in her town.
Absolutely, right. And so, you know, I gave her a nice interview, and she kind of got it. And a couple of days later, she called me really terrified and upset. And she said a federal agent had been to her office, had asked her to step outside. She said, can I bring my reporter's notebook? And he said, no, I'll be the one asking questions. Took her out, and started asking her questions like, you know, who did you talk to? Did he seem like a citizen? Did he seem like an American? Did he have a camera? He didn't take pictures, did he? Well, of course he took pictures. They're doing a story, you know, a news story. And he said there were possible international implications to me being that close to the unsecured border. Let alone, I came from Washington, D.C., where my office is three blocks from the White House. Now I'm a danger in northwestern North Dakota. So it turns out he was from the Border Protection, Customs and Border Protection. He went around and did that to everyone I interviewed so that I couldn't go back and get another interview. We were going to go back and do it the high school graduation, and we were unwelcomed at that point because people were worried. They were worried, are there international implications they don't know about? Had they said something that would put the country at risk to me, or even worse, maybe put themselves at risk from their own country? At the time, it was the NSA wiretapping story that was in the news. And even this reporter worried about calling her mom because was she now on the wiretap database, and would that put her mom on the list as well? I was going through this kind of weird time where I'm being followed by federal agents, and I'm just trying to do a story about the value of small-town America. Right in the middle of that, I get a call from an old friend who says that one of our best friends from high school had just died in Iraq. His little bird helicopter had been shot down in a battle south of Baghdad. And so I left, and I went home for his funeral. And at his funeral, he had two young kids. One was 5, one was about 18 months, or I guess 3 and 18 months. And one was named Luke, just like my son's name, Luke. All my old high school friends were there. And Jake, the youngest one, had a pacifier that was red, white, and blue, and it matched the coffin that they laid over Matt's coffin. I mean, yeah, the flag that they laid over Matt's coffin. And it just occurred to me that Matt had died fighting for an idea of America that was starting to resemble the state of America less and less. It wasn't... he didn't die for an America where federal agents went around following reporters who were doing stories about small-town America. He didn't die for America that's run by the kind of fear and xenophobia that was starting to shape our country. And it was really pretty sad and frustrating. And I called this federal agent back, and I asked him, you know, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? Why didn't you call me and ask me? And, you know, I was actually worked for the federal government longer than he had. I could have told him what I was doing there. But I knew that wasn't why he was following me. It wasn't because I was part of his job. It was because he didn't like Al Jazeera, because he thought he knew what Al Jazeera was, and he was going to intimidate me away from doing the story and intimidate anyone from speaking to me. But the whole story ended up just being kind of a sad commentary on where America is now.
So now Al Jazeera International has launched, but most people in this country cannot see it unless they're watching online or where in the country.
Right. And this is sad because it's one of the largest launches ever in history internationally. It started with 80 million homes. It's now the fastest growing network in the world. It's over 100 million homes. Even in Israel, they've taken the BBC World off the YES satellite system to put Al Jazeera English on in its place. Same down in South Africa. The Belgian foreign minister recently said he's addicted to Al Jazeera English, can't stop watching. And in America, it's the news they don't want you to see. You can only see it in local access cable in Burlington, Vermont, Toledo on Buckeyes Cable, at the Pentagon on Channel 36. They're watching. But it's really disappointing, not so much as a journalist, because I'm not sure Al Jazeera necessarily cares that much they're not in America. I mean, they're a lot more focused on the world. They're about the world, not just America. But as a citizen of America, it's disappointing we can't see this international news.
And Samuel Hajj, the Al Jazeera reporter, who has been at Guantanamo for close to 5 years, we only recently heard from him because of a quote that got out where he said, release Alan Johnston, the BBC reporter who is in Gaza in captivity, saying no reporter should be kidnapped.
Yeah, absolutely. Sammy, we believe, suffered the fate that a lot of people suffered in Afghanistan in the early days, where the U.S. government was offering $5,000 from anyone from the Taliban and $10,000 from anyone from Al-Qaeda. So a lot of the people, if anyone wasn't from that area, locals went and told the U.S. officials, hey, that guy's Al-Qaeda. They go and pick up this person, pay the guy $10,000, and now those people have gone through Bagram Air Force Base and stuck in Gitmo forever. Of course, Sammy wasn't from that area. He was there covering a story on behalf of Al Jazeera, and a local sold him away to the U.S. government. It's unbelievable.
Well, Josh Rushing, I want to thank you very much for being here. Mission Al Jazeera is his book. Build a bridge, seek the truth, change the world. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, war and censorship at Wilton High. Stay with us.
Masters of war, here that build the big guns, here that build the death planes, here that build all the bombs, here that hide behind walls, here that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world, like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire, and then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. Before threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed, you ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know but to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young, you might say I'm unlearned, but there's one thing I know, I'm younger than you. That even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul.
Bob Dylan, Masters of War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Over the last few weeks, audience members packed into several off-Broadway theaters in New York, at the Culture Project, at the Public Theater, to watch the curtain go up on an unusual production, a high school play about war. The play is called Voices in Conflict. It was performed by students from Wilton High School in Connecticut. The reason they were performing it on the New York stage instead of their Connecticut school auditorium? Well, their high school principal had banned it. It all started when Wilton High drama teacher Bonnie Dickinson and her students developed the idea of a play about Iraq. It was initially inspired by the death of Wilton High graduate Nicholas Medeiros from an improvised explosive device blast in Bakuba last September. The play uses real testimonials from soldiers, from their letters, blogs, taped interviews, and Levon Lahti's book, In Conflict. The voices of Iraqis are also included. After students spent months preparing the play, the school administration canceled it. Superintendent Gary Richards wrote, quote, "The student performers directly acting the part of the soldiers turns powerful material into a dramatic format that borders on being sensational and inappropriate. We would like to work with the students to complete a script that fully addresses our concerns." Well, the students did change the script. They incorporated his quote in the play. The controversy propelled Voices in Conflict onto the New York stage, where Wilton High students have performed it several times to standing ovations. Bonnie Dickinson is the play's director. She's been teaching at Wilton High for 13 years. She joins us in our Firehouse studio, along with Wilton High School students Courtney Stack, who's the choreographer of the play, and Jimmy Presson, who plays Iraq War veteran Charlie Anderson in the play. In fact, Charlie Anderson himself is joining us from a studio in Norfolk, Virginia, member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He served in Iraq from March to May of 2003. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Bonnie, tell us about the origins of the play and why we're not going to Wilton to see it.
You're not going to be able to see it in Wilton because we were not allowed to perform it on the stage in Wilton High School. The school felt that it was too biased and that it was plagiarized. So they did not want to have anything to do with it and did not
plagiarized?
Yes, that's one of the allegations, that it was plagiarized, that because they got a very early draft, and that draft did not have all the sources cited because it wasn't ready to be sourced yet, they decided that it was very bad academic practice and very unbalanced, and they just felt that it was not appropriate for education.
Jimmy, talk about what it was like to be on the stage. You played, among others, it's mainly voices. Describe the format of the play.
Well, the format's a reading, not a play, so everyone has their scripts in their hands. Most of the action is stationary, people sitting or standing at the front of the stage, reading bits from the different sources in the play, from magazines, from In Conflict, or from The Ground Truth. And there are two songs. One is an original song about kids at the Vietnam Wall, and another is a rap taken from Joshua Miles, who posted this, who has his rap posted on Army websites, and that's the part that's choreographed.
Courtney, how'd you get involved with the play?
Well, Bonnie was talking about how she wanted some choreography to go along with this rap, and I basically came up to her and told her that I've had a lot of dance experience and have been doing choreography for a long time, and so she sort of invited me to participate.
Nick Medeiros was a Wilton High grad.
He graduated last year, and then, or 2 years ago, and went and joined the military. I believe he was recruited. I'm not sure why he joined, but he joined, and was killed in an accident last August.
IED exploded.
Mm-hmm. And everybody loved this boy, and this is one of the reasons that we thought it might be a very good subject for a class project, because people would be aware of the issue, if for no other reason than we had lost a soldier from our town. That seemed to be the only interest we could glean on the war. It wasn't being taught in school particularly, that I knew of, this year. And we just thought it would be a great theater piece to investigate.
Jimmy, how often do you get to talk about war at school?
We very rarely to never talk about the war through the curriculum. In classes in which we discuss current events, we are required to not bring in current events that relate to the war.
Wait, what do you mean? What about social studies or history?
In history classes, the current events that we bring in are, we've been instructed to have the articles be unrelated to the war.
You're not allowed to talk about war in your history class?
We are not allowed to talk about the war.
Why?
Because it's too controversial, I guess. Because they don't want kids arguing.
Is there any class?
Or
that you can talk about it?
We can talk about it a little bit in Middle Eastern studies, a little bit, but it's not even that much in that class.
That class is not offered.
Every year. It's only offered every other year.
So this past year it wasn't offered?
It was not offered this past year.
So the only class to discuss this was in drama?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, at the public theater where you performed on Friday night, there were some soldiers in the audience, the soldiers that you, the students, played in this production of Voices in Conflict. We're joined by Charlie Anderson, as I said, an Iraq War vet, joining us now from Norfolk. Charlie, you were in the audience on Friday night?
Yes, I was, Amy. It was an excellent performance, and I was very honored to have been there.
Talk about your experience in Iraq, and Jimmy played you as one of the people. Is that right?
Yes, Jimmy did an excellent job portraying me. I was there for the invasion from March through May of 2003, and I learned of the play back in March, and I sent Bonnie and Jimmy a short email just saying that I was honored to be, that my voice was included in their production, and I thanked them for doing it, and I believe I said something about that I was distressed that it was being banned because the voices of those of us who have been there are largely silenced. And so it was, like I said, I was really happy to be able to see the play. In Iraq, we were pretty much on a constant advance, and I'm not saying I didn't have it any harder than anybody else over there, but that was what Jimmy did such an excellent job kind of portraying, was that the monologue talks about not being able to shower for weeks, never knowing when you're going to get attacked, never knowing really who or where your enemy is. And then the other part of it is what you really never see is the what happens when you come back, that nobody really wants to hear what you went through and just expects you to pick up like nothing happened. And for so many of us, we can't just pretend that the most significant event in our lives never happened.
I thought it was quite interesting that after the New York Times did an article about the banning of the play at Wilton High, Ira Levin wrote a piece, wrote a letter to the editor. He is the author of The Stepford Wives, and he wrote the paper letter that said, "Wilton, Connecticut, where I lived in the 1960s, was the inspiration for Stepford, the fictional town I later wrote about in The Stepford Wives. I'm not surprised that Wilton High School has a Stepford principal. Not all the Wilton High students have been Stepfordized. The ones who created and rehearsed the banished play Voices in Conflict are obviously thoughtful young people with minds of their own." So Wilton, Connecticut, is the actual real town that Stepford is based on.
The people in Wilton who read that article, that letter, were very upset and very ashamed and humiliated by that letter. And they were also very ashamed and humiliated by the New York Times article. And we had a lot of backlash from the town itself, from the high school itself, because we were singled out as having brought shame to Wilton. Most of the people in the town did not know anything about this. They did not really know the backstory. I'm not permitted to talk about what really happened. And a lot of covering up was done.
You're being investigated, Bonnie Dickinson,
They
drama
finally
teacher.
Finished it. They finally finished the investigation, or the, you know, the committee report on what I did and didn't do based on a parent complaint. And they've said that there's going to be no reprimand and no charges filed against me. But I want to make sure that nothing goes in my personnel file. Nothing.
For performing this play, maybe...
For doing this play, for researching this play, for plagiarizing this play, for doing anything. Because now they've said I'm publicly off the hook. I haven't done anything wrong. So I want to make sure nothing goes in my file.
Jimmy, we just have a few seconds. How do you feel having performed this? And do you think you'll ever get to perform it for your classmates at Wilton High?
Well, it's been a really exhilarating experience to share the voice of the soldiers at all. But I think we're optimistic that the people who are willing to listen from our school will come see the show, as some have already.
We're going to leave it at that. Bonnie Dickinson, thanks for joining us, drama teacher at Wilton High. Jimmy Presson, Wilton High School student, and Courtney Stack, another student, all participated in the play, Voices in Conflict. That does it for our show. Our website's democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.